or float it away where it's going to be a hazard to the wildlife in the area, and possibly oil more beaches down the line.
Ranger Joe Meehan says this is a particularly tough beach to clean, but if it's left like this, it'll go on killing seabirds and the scavengers, including bears, that feed on them. In its way, Kenai Fjords is one of the most spectacular parks in the national system. Its finger-like inlets fold more than 400 miles of shoreline into a coast that's barely 70 miles long. When the oil from the Exxon Valdez began to escape from Prince William Sound, the national park lay right in its path. Park officials aren't sure just how much of their coastline is fouled. Much of it is so rocky, with surf so violent, no boat or even helicopter can get close enough to look. Even so, a lot of the oil got past the headlands and deep into the sheltered waters, where it lodged on beaches like the one at the head of Black Bay. Cleanup crews have been over many parts of the oiled beaches, but often with a treatment that consists of little more than picking up tar balls and oily flotsam and leaving the soaked-in oil alone.
I think it's important to note that treated beach does not mean thoroughly treated, well-treated, or clean.
Park biologist Russ Kuczynski.
So when you hear that they've treated the beach, realize that the oil they got from the beach could be anywhere from 1% to 100% of the oil. It did not address the real impact on the beach, and it's those that is gross contaminant is what the eagles have gotten gooed up with, and other animals, including otter, and both sea otter and land otter. You can go to the beach and find as much oil as it was ever there, but again, it's a treated beach. And you know, from our perspective, that things of that nature are a dismal failure.
The park superintendent at Kenai Fjords worries that things aren't going to get any better this winter, especially if storms start washing the oil from damaged beaches and recontaminating others. Ann Castellina has been reviewing Exxon's winter spill plan.
We're not in it. They're going to put a couple of 150-foot skimmers and a couple in Valdez, and they're going to put one in Homer and one in Kodiak, and those are supposed to protect all four of the zones that are affected or will be or will continue to be affected by the oil. Do you know how hard it's going to be or how long it's going to take to get a boat from Homer and around Gore Point up here if there's a threat of oil? 20 hours at minimum if you can get a boat around Gore Point. The closest boat to us that's going to be able to offer any assistance is going to be in Homer. And yet, where is the oil coming out of Prince William Sound, should it continue to flush out this winter, going to hit first? Seward. We're the first in line.
The Seward Zone was the first in line when the great mass of spilled oil first made its way out of Prince William Sound. But as it washed ashore along the length of the Kenai Fjords and rounded the rocky prominence of Gore Point, it was clear the damage was just beginning. People in the fishing communities on the eastern shore of the Kenai Peninsula began to brace themselves for the worst. In English Bay, in Port Graham, in Seldovia, and in Homer, where Joe Gallagher takes up the story.
As oil from the Exxon Valdez was heading towards Cook Inlet and Kachemak Bay, Homer was transformed into one big meeting room. Every day, people would gather at Homer City Hall, the cannery, the local hotel, the high school, or wherever they could find information about the oil spill. The daily briefings became community events, where large crowds of people would show up, desperate for any news about the location of the oil. It was a period of high energy, combined with a growing sense of frustration that not enough was being done to protect the shoreline from the oil. That frustration boiled over April 12th at the Homer High School when Exxon officials made their first appearance in Homer and were confronted by angry local residents who wanted to see more done.
Where is it going to come together? You know,
it should be coming together in the next few weeks, I would hope, or less.
The next few weeks, we'll be standing in oil up to here going, boy, it's too bad that boom didn't arrive from all those other countries when we could have used stuff right here.
If we could get the boom and deliver it tomorrow, we would. We are striving. We're doing everything we can to get boom.
Exxon's effort to obtain protective boom material never satisfied local residents, and soon they made a decision to do it on their own. Overnight, a boom building operation sprouted up on the end of the Homer Spit, and over in Seldovia, the entire town took up the cause. Kids even took the day off from school to lend a hand down on the beach building boom. At the time, Exxon was telling Seldovians that commercial boom was on the way and not to worry. But Seldovia Mayor Gerald Willard wasn't all that interested in what Exxon had to say.
We just flat don't care. We feel Exxon Oil Company is the one that dropped the oil in the bays. Now, if we could call Norvik, Sweden or wherever, and they have oil boom, we almost feel like someone should pick up a phone and call them and say, send us the oil boom or whatever, And so anyway, it's easy to get frustrated.
Eventually, Exxon took over the log boom building operation, but a sense that the company was slow in trying to locate commercial boom left a bad feeling in Kachemak Bay communities. That feeling was persistent throughout the cleanup effort. Requests from communities for assistance were caught up in a bureaucratic logjam and often went unanswered. No one was satisfied with the response from Exxon, and those complaints were aired loud and clear during visits from Governor Cooper, Representative Don Young, and Senator Ted Stevens. Senator Stevens was pulled away from a dinner at Land's End to address a crowd of angry protesters who wanted to know what was being done by the government to help clean up the oil.
You spend a lot of your taxpayers' money already. We're under severe criticism in the rest of the country for having spent it. I don't know if you know that. There are people in this country that think Alaskans should pay totally for this recovery.
No. We should.
I'll show you the articles if you don't believe it.
No, please
The law puts the burden for this recovery on Exxon, and that's where it's going to stay.
Well, we need to change that law.
We are going to change that law. We are going to change that law to make sure that...
The official visits continued, and so did the progress of the oil. Each day it moved closer to the Kachemak Bay villages of English Bay and Port Graham. Village leaders urged Exxon to mount an aggressive effort to pick up the oil before it landed on the beaches that are used for subsistence. Instead of waiting for Exxon to take control, a group of fishermen from Seldovia organized their own cleanup fleet and, with buckets and dip nets, went out and began attacking the oil. Meanwhile, in the villages, people were going out trying to collect their traditional food before it was contaminated. English Bay resident Emily Swenning was worried that the oil was going to wipe out an important part of native culture that village children were just beginning to learn about.
They won't even know what it, what a bedarkie tastes like. It's like that much of the generation has lost something that we... It's just that I'm trying to cry. The things we learned from our parents, our kids won't know. Because one stupid guy screwed up and it had to affect a lot of people. And you feel so helpless because there's nothing you can really do and just wait for Exxon or one of the corporations to help get the stuff ready to clean up. And none of them have called us just in case it gets here.
The oil did arrive in Kachemak Bay. Tarballs floated up on the beach in Port Graham and English Bay. And eventually, oil was found on beaches in Homer, Anchor Point, and all the way up towards Nanilchik. The disaster that happened hundreds of miles away ended up in Homer's backyard. The Department of Fish and Game began monitoring the waters of Cook Inlet and found tarballs floating in an area where the commercial salmon drift fleet does most of its fishing. The oil never went away, and the multi-million-dollar upper inlet drift season was canceled. Exxon has made payments to the fishermen for the lost season, but the fleet isn't satisfied with the amount of money paid out, and negotiations are continuing. Jerry Wills has been fishing in the upper inlet for 30 years. He tried to explain what the closure meant to him.
It's terrible. You visit with some of your old-time friends, and you don't even want to talk about this thing, and yet you have to. And the feelings are not good. The feelings are 180 degrees from what you'd normally be sharing at this time of year. You'd normally be maybe strutting into the river at the end of a long, hard day, exhausted, but exhaustion came from super hard work, and it's just a great, great feeling. And instead of those feelings, we're feeling just totally different. It made me so sick the other day when I heard they were closing this down that I wanted to cry. You know, a grown man Alaskan fisherman doesn't cry, right?
This year's salmon run in Upper Cook Inlet was almost twice the projected level, and the drift fleet lost out on a harvest that would have been worth approximately $46 million. Exxon's cleanup effort on the outer coast of the Kenai Peninsula is just about over with. The company says it's leaving the coast in an environmentally stable condition and will make a decision about any further work next spring. The state strongly disagrees with Exxon's assessment of the situation. Fish and game biologists continue to find oil on the beach and in salmon streams up and down the coast. And they say further damage to wildlife will occur unless more work is done. Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
This is the Alaska Oil Spill on National Call-In. Coming up, Dennis Kelso, Alaska's Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, and Otto Harrison, Exxon's Operations Manager. The telephone number to call is 800-325-1100. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. Nationwide call-in is made possible by APRN member stations and the Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission. The toll-free line courtesy of Alascom. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'm Pat Bodner. Coming up, a look at the oil spill through the eyes of Dennis Kelso, Alaska's Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. He's in our studios, ready to take your calls at 800-325-1100. But first, let's continue to track the nation's largest oil spill as it stained beaches out in the Gulf of Alaska. The Prince William Sound oil spill soon outgrew that name as most of the oil escaped the sound and headed to Kenai Fjords and out to sea toward Kodiak, where, as Charlene Parent reports, fishermen watched helplessly as the crude poisoned the salmon streams they rely on for their living.
Local officials held the first of what would become daily town meetings
volunteers organized vessels and materials, and messengers brought word from the front lines. Pilot Bob Stanford.
The skimming operations, they're ridiculous. Nothing, it's not stopping it. The booms, these booms are worthless. I've seen booms in every little bite on Night Island, in all over that sound.
Bob,
I've flown it for 8 years.
You have a suggestion on what we can do?
Let me finish, please.
Well,
let me finish, please.
Sure.
Yeah, I've seen one area that possibly is going to contain that oil, and that's the fishermen of Cordova stopped it in San Juan. And they have perfect weather. You must remember, it's inside waters. It's flat calm. It's nothing like it's going to be here. We must pick it up. We've got to stop it. We've got to pick it up, and we've got to catch it before it destroys this island.
That became the rallying cry, urging Exxon to get in front of the spill, to attack the free-floating oil before it could reach shore. Islanders braced themselves to do battle with the oil, but the biggest battle was in trying to move the corporate giant to action, Exxon spokesman Monty Taylor in the first week of April. Archipelago at Shuyak Island, and Exxon took over cleanup operations from the borough. Soon, Katmai National Park got hit, and attention focused on the Alaska Peninsula. While Katmai cleanup workers dealt with bad weather and bears coming out of hibernation, oil continued down the coast and threatened Chignik. Meanwhile, on Kodiak, the northern and western villages faced the most imminent threat, but village residents felt uninformed and ignored. Mayor of Karluk, Ronnie Lind.
My way of life, a subsistence way of life, is really threatened. And I don't see you out there trying to, or anybody up in that town up there asking us how we feel. I mean, you go out there, we live off the fish now, and then we get a word on the radio, don't touch the fish. Don't touch the clams. Now we've got these tar balls rolling up on the beaches, and they're saying they ain't going to hurt you, and yet when they leave from here, they call back down and say, don't touch the fish. Don't touch this stuff. What do we do with that stuff? Do we just let it sit on the beach and melt? I mean, this has been going on, no attention to these villages. They're there, they're people. And they have to live with it.
Soon, Kodiak found itself engaged in a guerrilla war. The weathered crude was a moving target, difficult to track. It shifted with the tides, drifted underneath the surface of the water, and ricocheted between Kodiak and the mainland, oiling and re-oiling beaches. By and large, the Gulf region was considered lightly oiled compared to Prince William Sound. So local authorities had difficulty impressing the scope of the problem upon the decision makers in Valdez. Coast Guard Commander Ford.
The unique circumstances over here in Kodiak that somehow or another escaped not only our superior's eyes, but the eyes of a lot of other agencies over in Valdez, because they seem to be so myopic with what's going over in Prince William Sound that it diminishes what's happening in these other areas, much to our detriment.
As summer approached, cleanup efforts increased. But increasing at far greater speed was the number of miles of impacted shoreline. The oil kept coming. Soon it was salmon season, or it was supposed to be.
It's fish that's kept Kodiak rich. I'm Lainey Welch. Unlike the rest of Alaska, Kodiak has never depended on oil. A single red salmon is still worth more than a barrel of oil, and last year, with a value of $164 million, Kodiak was the number one port in the nation. But when its fisheries were seriously hit by the spill, it changed Kodiak's economic base. Over half the area's herring fisheries were shut down. Bottom fish quotas were taken earlier than usual when more effort was shifted there. When it was apparent there would not be much of a salmon fishery, money earned became dependent on how well one could wheel an Exxon cleanup deal or on how well one fit into Exxon's claims system. Many caught on quickly to the rules that run an oil spill economy. Fishermen who chartered their boats for oil cleanup received up to $4,400 a day. Those who owned a salmon permit also got compensated for not being able to fish. Exxon estimates they paid $10 million to 600 Kodiak permit holders by early August. Cannery workers also received payments for work lost. But the compensation system left out large groups of people directly affected by the spill. Those with fishing permits didn't need crews. Those who customarily provided permit holders with boats found themselves with no profits to share. Kodiak boat owner Tammy Gould.
Because we don't fall within the Exxon guidelines, we have not been able to receive a dime. We are living on nothing. We're in danger of losing our boat in the middle of August because we can't pay our insurance. I am frustrated. I'm scared. We've made sacrifices in our lives, and we're watching everything go down. Straight down. Nobody can give us any answers. Exxon is a giant corporation for a small individual group. But we need help. We didn't do anything wrong. We didn't do anything wrong.
Every day, radios all over the island tuned to the oil spill meeting where human dramas unfolded. It was the one forum where every agency gave status reports. It provided the only place where anyone could ask any question for all to hear. The oil spill meetings became the place where islanders learned what others were doing. It was where a scrappy group of saners announced they had bypassed Exxon's bureaucracy and with efficient, low-tech methods cleaned up 1,000 pounds of oil in little over an hour. It was where fishermen of all gear groups set aside traditional differences and united in a common cause. But fishermen's hopes for a salmon season faded with the passing of summer. Only one of Kodiak's 52 salmon fishing areas was opened. That fishery alone contributed $100 million to Kodiak's economy last year. Now, as oil continues to reemerge with the regularity of the tides, islanders fear for the fish. They won't know how they fared until spring. For salmon, which use their highly refined sense of smell to guide them back to their spawning streams after a year or more at sea, some people half-jokingly say, for all we know, they could all come back to the fuel docks. I'm Lainey Welch.
For Prince William Sound, the spill was like a sudden, unexpected death. For the Gulf region, it's been more like a lingering degenerative illness. This is the spill's legacy. By far the greatest number of oil spill-related bird deaths occurred in the Kodiak Zone, which includes Katmai and Aniakchak National Parks, and the mortalities continue to mount. Wildlife managers report seeing bears and other wildlife feeding off oiled carcasses. It remains to be seen how the oil will affect those populations, just as it remains to be seen what role oil played in the deaths of gray whales found washed up this summer. And then there's the human toll. The spill disrupted village life. Old Harbor's Mayor, Sven Hawkinson.
It really hurt the villages and their lifestyle, family relations, and everything because of the Exxon effort. Some people, yes, made more money, but I think it hurt them off worse by not going fishing. And it really, you can see the difference when the parents usually or the mothers and stuff are home with their children during the summer. And now you see they're all working and never with them, and children are getting in trouble and doing a lot of things that never would happen.
Like a lot of the oil around Kodiak, the impacts are not always visible from the surface. Kodiak's suicide rate jumped dramatically starting in April. No one can say it was because of the spill, but it's one indicator of the level of stress in the community. Caseloads rose at the Kodiak Council on Alcoholism and the Women's Resource and Crisis Center, and the Mental Health Center alone reported a higher than 600% client increase. Health professionals will be trying to pick up the pieces this winter. Meanwhile, the oil spill continues. The fall bird migration is in progress, The Department of Environmental Conservation estimates 40% to 60% of the oil is still unaccounted for, and experts say Prince William Sound undergoes a flushing in September and October. Both the Kodiak Island Borough and a concerned citizens group plan to continue with a modified cleanup program. Kodiak is not content to rest this winter. As Larson Bay Mayor Charles Christensen says, there's too much at stake.
We are all fishermen in our area down there. Women and children and all go fishing. That's our livelihood. Now, if this isn't continuing for the winter, we're afraid that we're not going to be able to fish again next year.
In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
And that's our look at the long stretch of the path of the oil spills that moved out of Prince William Sound and down along the whole Gulf of Alaska coast. We're back. This is a call-in, your opportunity to talk about the oil spill and to the people who have been most concerned with the decision-making in the oil spill. Our guest right now in the studio is Dennis Kelso, who's Alaska's Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. He's also served the state before as a deputy commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game. He's headed up Fish and Game Subsistence Division. He's an attorney who's worked for the public defenders, has a long career in Alaska, and who was right on the spot immediately after the oil spill. This is your opportunity to talk to him. The number here is toll-free. It's 800-325-1100. Good morning, Denny, and welcome.
Good morning, Corey. Thank you.
I gather that you're most busy right now with the implementation of the winter spill plan that the governor announced in Valdez yesterday. What's up first?
First of all, we're going to be getting together with local communities. We want to work through the local governments in putting very specific shoreline treatment efforts into place. We don't want to be duplicating what Exxon is doing, and we certainly don't want to try to do what Exxon is doing this summer. But we want to be precise. The local communities know the most important areas for them and the things that they can accomplish, and we want to work with them to see that job get done. We're also going to put into place a review of the technology available for shoreline cleanup. We're going to spend the time over the winter looking at methods that may have been suggested but not tried. And we're going to also look at the condition of the shoreline, map it, continue to survey it so we know what the progress of the spill is over the winter and what its condition is. And we will do whatever we need to do so that there is an emergency response capability in Prince William Sound and other locations where we need to have it. Exxon may do some things along those lines that will be helpful, but we want to make sure that effort is adequate, and so we plan to fill the gaps as we need to. It's going to be a very busy winter season. We're also going to have, this won't be my department so much, but we will make sure that there is assistance to communities for community health, including public, including mental health assistance, which the governor feels very strongly about.
Dennis, so this is Pat Bodner. What are your concerns as the winter approaches regarding the mental health and community? How hard have communities been hit psychologically, sociologically, by the oil spill?
In talking with people in the communities and the officials of those communities, it's clear that people have been hit very hard. Some people were able to use their equipment to assist Exxon, and some of them made money doing that. Others did not. Communities lost a large portion of their fishing income, for example. In Kodiak, 90% of the salmon fishery was really lost this year. So there's a lot of uncertainty. What about next year? Will we be able to fish? Will our communities be able to sustain themselves in the way we have before? For subsistence communities, should we be afraid of our food supply? And what will happen next year after the oil has been on the beach for basically almost a year? So there's a lot of uncertainty. We want to address as much of that as we can directly, and the things that we can't address, then we will work with the local communities to try to find the best way of protecting people and giving them a sense of confidence that we can go forward together.
Our guest is Conservation Commissioner Dennis Kelso, and this is your opportunity to talk to him. The toll-free number is 800-325-1100. We have a caller on the line from Anchorage. Anchorage, good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. This is John Graham, and I want to first of all, commend Dennis Kelso on being the kind of public servant that we look to. And
I'm sorry, it's nice of you to compliment him, but we need your question.
Okay, well, it's not so much a question. I want to bring up the big picture and the issue of in 1976, our legislature, through a democratic process, enacted a law that was that regulated the tanker traffic coming out of Valdez, and it was this bill came from Chancey Croft in his leaner days, and that's he was involved in most of the legislation, and he was my representative. I'm from downtown Anchorage. I was born and raised there, and I've been an environmentalist.
We need to hear your comment.
Okay. Well, what is it, a comment or a question? I mean, this is a very important issue because...
Okay, you're developing a comment about that Chancey Croft legislation in 77 and what happened
that,
to it, right?
That became law. Okay. I'll read you a letter from Tony Croft.
We don't have time to read letters. We need to know what you think about what happened with that legislation.
Well, I believe that there is corruption in the court system, and the public gets a glimpse of what goes on with the people in power, and it is difficult to explain a big picture if you don't want to hear me out. I don't know. I could ask Dennis Kelso what he knows of this tanker bill that I believe would have prevented the oil spill. The whole issue was debated, and what and how it relates to the present time. Now, I'll bring
that
one.
That was shot down by the federal courts. Is that are you asking
well,
for
a response?
Well, it
was shot down by a particular judge, Fitzgerald, that was
rewarded
with a federal judgeship. We're going
to have to move on. Thank you for your comment.
I think the point that John raises is an important one in the sense that Alaska had tried to take action to protect itself against tanker spills by requiring safety standards for tankers. And, for example, we were very much committed to double hulls, double bottoms. And that's what was overturned in the courts. And, of course, had there been double hull in place with this tanker, it would have been a very different spill. It would have prevented a good share of the damage. So that's the kind of thing we should look into again. And that would require federal action, not just double hulls, double bottoms, but what about all aspects of tanker design, construction, how tankers operate, and the tanker traffic controls? All of those need some careful attention. It needs to happen right now.
Our number to call is 800-325-1100. Our next caller is Nancy Bird from Cordova. So, good morning, Nancy. What is your question? Are you with us, Nancy?
Hello?
Oh, that doesn't sound like Nancy.
No, it isn't.
It must be Juno.
Yeah.
Are you, well, caller from Juno, pardon me. We were just told that Nancy Bird was on the line. But what's your question?
Well, first of all, I'm not going to take a lot of time, but I would like to commend the commissioner for the wonderful job I think he's done in battling Exxon's disinformation campaign on national television. He's come across very well as an advocate for the state of Alaska and its citizens and their interest in trying to mitigate this horrendous damage that's been caused. And my question is actually somewhat personal because I'm wondering what it would take, and I realize the commissioner has a lot of things to do, but I'm wondering what it would take to get him to run for governor.
Well, I can answer that pretty quickly. I don't have any particular political ambitions. I'm more interested in seeing this job get done on the spill right now. I'm very flattered that people think of me that way, and I appreciate that. I believe in public service by private citizens, but right now we've got a spill on our hands, and we've got a long ways to go, so I'm trying to give my attention to that.
Thank you. Our next caller really is Nancy Bird from Cordova. Nancy, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay.
I have two questions, I guess. First, I understand that Denny Kelso went out to Prince William Sound yesterday and I'm curious what his comments are specifically regarding the garbage on beaches. We've been hearing reports in Cordova of garbage having been left, and I'd like to get a first-hand opinion. The second question would be related to the federal legislation that's now being considered, specifically related to the states' rights issue, if Mr. Kelso would comment on that.
Yes, Nancy. I was out in the Sound on the shoreline on Thursday afternoon and evening, and I observed some debris on the beaches that was obviously left from treatment operations there. And I think that that needs to be picked up over the winter. We shouldn't just let that stuff be floating around oily, drifting either toward one of the hatchery sites or somewhere else. So that needs careful attention. My greater concern has to do with the overall condition of the beaches, including debris, such as the debris you mentioned. I think there is a tendency for people to assume that if the shoreline stretch has been treated, that means it's clean. And that's certainly not the case. We're glad that progress has been made, and many of the shoreline beaches look better than they looked before, at least on the surface. But if you roll over a few rocks, if you dig a little bit into the gravel, most of them have plenty of oil there, and that oil may extend 30 or 40 inches into the gravel or cobble, depending on what the beach is made of. So I think it's very important for us not to forget that there is a lot of work yet to be done. That's not to say we don't value the work that's been accomplished or the hard work of the crews that have been trying to get the job handled, but we've got a long ways to go. So that's how I see that, and the debris is part of that, but certainly not the end of the story. With regard to the legislation, and this is absolutely crucial, I think we have to keep in mind that there are things we can do here so that this doesn't happen again. There are some things we can do to make sure that the spiller is not in charge of deciding how much work to do or how long to do it. And one key is to get some federal legislation that makes it clear that the government is in charge of directing the spill, not the spiller, or directing the spill response, not the spiller. A crucial change. Right now, the spiller, under both state and federal law, has the right to do the containment and cleanup. And it's only if they either refuse to do it or mess it up so badly that it's about the same thing as refusing to do it, that the Coast Guard or the state can step in, push them aside, and say, we're going to direct this thing. That needs to be changed. It's backwards, and it needs to be straightened out. In the course of that, though, it would be a serious mistake if Congress were to preempt the state and local authorities. And there is some legislation in the House of Representatives right now that would do that. That is a bad idea, and this spill demonstrates how important the role of the local people and of the state is in making sure that the job gets done right. Under the legislation that's being considered by the House now, the state would be preempted. We wouldn't be able to do what we have done during this spill. We wouldn't be able to do the winter work plan that the governor announced. So that simply needs to be changed to make sure that we have the authority we need. The Coast Guard needs to have a role. They do a good job of what they do, but their role is different than the role of the state and the local folks, and we have to have both if we're going to be effective.
Our number to call is 800-325-1100. Dennis Kelso is our guest. He's Alaska Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. And we've got a call waiting from Fairbanks. Good morning, Fairbanks.
We're still on the line.
Oh, Nancy, I'm sorry.
Nancy Bird from Cordova. So Nancy, did you have another question? I hear air out there, and it doesn't sound like Cordova. We had a couple of calls earlier, Commissioner, talking about the relatively minuscule amount of money, $21 million that the state's devoting to the winter spill program, and comparing that to the nearly $2 billion that Exxon says it's spent. What do you think can be done with that small amount of money? Is this really a serious attempt?
I think it is a very serious effort. Bear in mind that the $21 million that the governor has committed to this work is between now and the end of December. This is not for the full winter effort. We'll take stock of where we stand at the end of December and then make a decision on what other money may be needed. We also spend that money differently than Exxon has spent its money. Exxon brought in sort of a flotilla of vessels and really mobilized a lot of equipment, and they should get credit for the mobilization. But I think they spent a whole lot more money than we would spend. Certainly, the state and the local governments are used to spending money much more tightly than Exxon did, which is not to knock the fact that Exxon spent a lot of money, but we expect to target this very precisely, and that's why we have spent a good share of the last several weeks designing this plan and why we're going to be working with the local people. We're not going to shower this problem with money. We're going to be surgical in our effort to deal with it, and we're not going to duplicate what Exxon's doing. We'd like to reach out to Exxon and say, join us in this effort. There's room for everybody, and we can be cooperative in this. But if Exxon is reluctant to do the field work that we think should be done, then we'll go ahead and do it. We'll bill Exxon. If Exxon picks up the tab initially, fine, that'll give us more money to work with to do additional work this winter. If not, we'll go ahead and do the work anyway. We'll send them the bill, and if they don't pay it, we'll add it to our lawsuit. So we'll stretch that $21 million a long way. Is it a lot by comparison to the amount that Exxon has spent already? Of course not. But the spiller is responsible for the cleanup. The basic principle is, if you make a mess, you've got to clean it up. That's why we think Exxon should not only pay for this, but we hope they will join us for a good share of the work in the winter and be committed to come back in the spring. So far, that's not entirely clear. They said they would come back and do work in the spring, but we want to make sure it's the work that the state and local people believe needs to be done, and we're going to lay the foundation this winter so that can go forward.
And is Exxon willing to be supervised by the state?
Well, I think that's a question that they have sidestepped time and again. They need to remember that the state has legal authority here. This isn't just some negotiation with a commercial partner. This is the representative of the people of the state of Alaska carrying out the rules that the people have set for the conduct of business in this state. So, no, Exxon has resisted the idea that they should do what the state requires. They say they will work with the Federal On-Scene Coordinator. Of course, we will work with the Federal On-Scene Coordinator, too. We've always been committed to that. But we think that Exxon needs to remember that here in the state of Alaska, they are doing business with people whose government represents them and whose government has standards to protect them. And if they want to maintain tanker traffic here and utilize our resources as they appear to want to do, they ought to keep in mind that our rules are for them to follow.
And what kind of advice do you give to people out there in communities who we've been running into as we go around and cover this story, who want to do something, who want to pitch in? How do you advise them?
My first advice would be for them to stay in touch with their local community, either the MAC group, if there is one, or the local emergency response team, and with the local government, and we'll be working with those entities as we put this winter plan together.
Our guest is the state's Environmental Commissioner, Dennis Kelso, who's here with us to answer your calls. The number is 800-325-1100. You're listening to the Voices of Alaska on the Alaska Oil Spill, a nationwide call-in. We have another caller on the line, this time from Fairbanks. We'll be up in just a moment.
This program is made possible by Alaska Public Radio member stations, the Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission, and individual contributions to APRN's Disaster Coverage Fund. The toll-free line courtesy of Alascom.
Fairbanks, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. There have been reports that indicate that the state and the DEC and the oil companies were aware that the state of readiness originally required of Alyeska for an oil spill declined catastrophically over the years. There were alarms raised, but there was obviously no response. I want to know what other unthinkable time bombs in Alaska or elsewhere in the U.S., if you know,
are waiting to happen, situations where we or the industry have to afford the ounce of prevention to prevent an oil spill or contamination of the groundwater or radioactive contamination or whatever.
Well, you've already listed some very important ones, but let me say just a word about the state of readiness for Alyeska. The Alyeska Pipeline Service Company was responsible to do the response. They were identified by Exxon as their agent in this matter. And the oil spill plan that existed had been hammered out with Alyeska and over Alyeska's objections over a period of 18 months. That plan was simply not carried out by Alyeska. And afterwards, incredibly enough, Alyeska insisted that this really was just a set of advisory guidelines, that they weren't really required to have it, and that they had carried it out because all they were required to do is what they wanted to do under the general response guidelines that they had identified in the plan. That's totally bogus. They were required to carry out the framework of that plan. That's what it's there for. That's what state law requires. The fact that they failed to do it should be rejected, and we should look at ways to make sure that they never miss it again. And we've already taken steps through an emergency order by me and also a complete recall of the